It's a great pleasure to welcome back Matt Peterson. Matthew is the managing partner of Peterson Capital Management, a concentrated long-term value-based fund with a 10-year track record and more than 15% annualized returns. Matt has been working as a financial professional for 2 decades. Before forming Peterson Capital Management, he split time between Wall Street and London as capital markets manager at Diamond Management and Technology Consultants, with expertise spanning risk management and derivative processing. I've enjoyed your presentations, Matt. I very much look forward to this presentation as well, so I'll turn it to you. Please go ahead.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here. It's great to be part of this entire community. We're going to go through Daily Journal from the lens of management business value. I'm going to go through the internal portfolio so you can understand what makes up that component. I'm going to describe a bunch of the missing revenue that's completely absent from the financial statement. And I'm going to explain, I'll try and get here quickly to the risk component because there are some major considerations when it comes to the main subsidiary. And I'll leave you with an updated scuttlebutt summary. So what is Daily Journal Co? Most of your audience, John, are going to be familiar with the firm, but the rest of the world is not. This is a total secret. Daily Journal Company is an American publishing and technology firm, and it's totally misunderstood because they have this hidden business model, which is the technology piece. There are zero analysts, there's no investor relations, there's significant off financial statement value, and it's very much undervalued from a Fisher and Graham perspective, specifically Fisher perspective, and we can evaluate the Graham perspective. And it's a micro cap compounder in a huge space, sub 500 million market cap. And there's just an extraordinarily high quality board and management team. So as I mentioned, we're going to look through it from the lens of what's the business model, management, and value. And as I'll quickly show you, this checks all of those boxes. And I think if you get something rare enough to satisfy those, you've found yourself a very special situation. So let's quickly get started with management. So who runs the Daily Journal Corporation? So many people will be familiar with Charlie Munger being on the board. Everyone's familiar with Charlie Munger. And these are in no particular order, but everybody will recall Peter Kaufman as the author of Poor Charlie's Almanac. He's also the CEO of Glenair and a very wise and actually young man. So we also have Salzman, CEO, CFO, treasurer, and secretary. It was a very strange company for 35 years. And Conlin is the newest member of the board, Mary Conlin. She just joined in May 2020, and she has a very interesting, unique background. She was the head of marketing at Pixar. She was the director of international distribution at Warner Brothers, and she went to Harvard. But Charlie Munger's been running this firm for 44 years. So it took a long time to figure out who she actually is, but it's, you know, Charlie Munger. So I actually had to go back to a wedding invitation from the 90s to learn that Mary Conlin was born Mary Murphy. And Mary Murphy is the daughter of Tom Murphy, who built Capital Cities ABC. And if you look at it from that perspective, it's sort of interesting. Anybody can go and read The Outsiders by William Thorndike to see all of his success. When Thomas Murphy became CEO, Mary, if I've done the math correctly, would have been one. 30 years later, it was widely considered one of the most successful, you know, he's considered one of the most successful CEOs of the century. So I'm very excited and pleased to have Mary joining this board. Rick Guerin sadly passed away last year. He's missed very much by everybody. And Gary Wilcox is moving on. So the first level concern that everybody has is everybody's pretty old. And so there's a concern about age, and there's also concern about technological capability. But keep in mind, there are only 300 employees at the entire firm, built over 44 years. So this firm is stacked with much less famous leaders. So from David Smith, who's in Australia, to Danny, who's the director of implementation, these folks are the future a daily journal, and specifically the subsidiary Journal Technologies. And there's these top six, there's another dozen of these key managers who are doing tremendous work. And of course, this isn't the full list, but over the years, doing all sorts of scuttlebutt research, these are the names in no particular order that are coming up over and over and over again. So this is management, and this is the future, and it is absolutely stacked with high quality individuals. So what is the business? The business I'll go through briefly, and you can always go back to the other presentation a couple of years ago to get a little more detail if you need it on the business. So 44 years ago, Rick Gurin and Charlie Munger, both, you know, considered the super investors of Graham and Doddsville, bought a little newspaper, a legal newspaper called Daily Journal for $2 million. So 44 years ago, it was a newspaper, which is why everybody confuses it for a newspaper business today. They built it into a 10 newspaper business, but very importantly, in 2009, Munger and Rick bottom ticked the market to the day and put all of their cash into the markets. And it was about $50 million at the time. That's grown tremendously over the years, as you can imagine. And we'll get into that in a little bit. In 2012 and 2013, they took a margin loan against this portfolio, $30 million margin loan at a very low interest rate, and used it to acquire New Dawn and ISD, which was going to supplement their sustained technology, which has been in development since the 90s. And of course, in 2017, 18, 19, and today, they are now becoming a very important software as a service provider in for courts and agencies globally. And this hidden SaaS subsidiary, Journal Technologies, is the future of Daily Journal. So let's add up the value of the parts here. So we have Daily Journal, 470 million market cap. I think at the end of the day I checked, it was around 463 million market cap. They have these newspapers, and I'm just going to write them off at zero. They're not at zero. They have significant subs. They're declining, but they still have 15 million in revenue. Not hugely profitable, but it's not zero. But we'll just keep it in there as a hidden asset. We then have this investment portfolio that we'll talk about, and then we need to figure out what's the value of the Journal Technology piece. And it's very important to keep in mind. This is all tucked into a little micro cap, and truly the technology piece, again, is going to be the future. So let's start with the portfolio because it's very concrete. What does the portfolio consist of? Some of this you have to really dig to uncover, but basically they have a $311 million equity portfolio. It consists 56% is BYD stock. So that is their foreign security. They have trimmed that a little bit. Basically in Q4, they trimmed a little bit. They completely sold out of their Hyundai Preferred, which was their other international equity holding. And in addition, they have shares of Bank of America, Wells Fargo, US Bank, and a little sliver of POSCO. And so that you can add up to 311 million. They have a lot of cash for this little company. So they've got 27 million sitting in cash, and they have three office buildings, which are valued on the financial statements at 17 million. I've actually gone out and done some comparables because particularly the Los Angeles offices, there's Los Angeles offices and an office in Logan, Utah. The ones particularly in Los Angeles haven't been revalued for 20 years. And so if you do the comparables, it's really more like 33 million might be a fair market value for the real estate, but I'm not going to change it. We're just going to leave it there and make this conservative statement. But so this is real estate value 20 years ago. So add it all up. You have 355 million right here, just in high quality, basically liquid assets. And then they have the most interesting debt profile of almost any company I've ever uncovered. The majority of the debt is the deferred capital gains tax, which of course is at 0%. And you have to wonder, you know, is this debt? Is it float? It's non-callable. They never have to pay it. So how do you think about this debt? I think it's a very low risk type of debt, but let's just treat it as debt and we'll remove it for the, you know, total enterprise value. They have a margin loan, which they used to build this software piece. And they basically took out a $30 million loan and they have about a 3% interest rate on that. Again, it's non-callable. It's a very special type of debt. because it's serviced by actually the dividends from the banks of their portfolio. And so they keep it pretty stable, actually, and just kind of cover the interest. And then there's the very small mortgage outstanding, $1.5 million. So $91 million debt off of the $355 million in these assets. And you basically end up with $206 million. By the way, because the market cap is a little down today, we can go through this and say it's under $200 million today to buy this journal technology piece. That's what the market is pricing at today. So again, you can go back into the old presentation to hear more about journal technologies at a high level, but I'm going to jump right into some more detail. Now, what is journal technology? So first of all, it's a court and agency software solution. They operate in an enormous space. They are transforming the courts and these external agencies from sort of the analog era into the digital. It's a multi-year massive expansion taking place. And the contracts that they win through this RFP process are almost always 10-year contracts. So they are very sticky revenue producing contracts, and they're very large. So one thing to point out immediately is that one of their competitive advantages and just the general ethos is that they operate under this deferred gratification method. And so when they win a new contract, there is zero billing done to the municipality, or in the US can be entire states. And there's no billing that's done until the software goes live. And this really helps them get through the bureaucratic process of, you know, winning an RFP, calculating IRRs. A lot of this is they're spending taxpayer money to build out these enhancements, and I think a challenging space to be operating in. So what does the timeline look like? Because I want to share with you why there's so much revenue that's totally missing from the financial statements. So they spend about a year, and some of this can take longer, by the way, but they spend about a year in this RFP process. And then So Journals Technologies is selected. They then spend another year defining the scope, doing the analysis on where the courthouse is and where they want to be, and figuring out the statement of work. During the same year, they're setting up test environments at JTI, doing all the configurations that are going to be necessary to do the build. Now, two or so years in, they start establishing servers on site. They also operate with the cloud and AWS. And once that's all done, now they can install the initial E-Series or E-Suites product, as it's called. This might take a month just to get everything sort of set up. But this is, one ex-employee described it to me as, a toolbox without any tools in it. So you now have this technology that can do so much, but you need to configure it. So many interfaces, so many different agencies, so much detail, and all of the users inside the courthouse kind of want everything. So they spend 6 to 24 months, and as I'll get into in the risks, sometimes longer, doing these configurations to the specifications of the client. And it takes a very long time. And it is not until this is completed and the software goes live that they bill for the first time. And that standard procedure often takes 4 to 7 years before any revenue shows up. And that's a long time to wait. So I went through a couple of years ago, because it's totally missing. There's no line item for this revenue. And I had to figure out how we could account for this. So I went with an intern back through county by county around America, following breadcrumbs that led us over into Australia and all these other places in Canada, seeing if we could identify these contracts from the state and city, municipality, county perspective, because somewhere on their books and records, they should be accounting for the fact that they owe Journal Technologies money. And we found over 100 contracts. We haven't found them all. And we found some big ones. So I'm sharing some of those with you now. So they have these things like the court service in Victoria. They are in an $89 million contract with them right now. We expect that go live probably to happen maybe in 2023, maybe 2024, maybe 2022, but in a couple of years. And I've listed out a few others here, Lake County, Illinois, Spokane, Beaverton, Oregon, Austin, Texas, Austin owes them $1 million. Australia has two other contracts in addition to this $89 million contract. Canada has a few, and we've even found one in Tasmania. So in 2017, at the annual meeting, Munger said, you can't look at our financial statements and make very good judgments about what's going to happen. And this is exactly why. So there are dozens of implementations taking place. They're accounting for all of the costs today. So the financial statements has all the costs, but it's missing all of this revenue. So how does this revenue show up? So first of all, there's an implementation fee, and then the rest of this contract is only for the licensing aspect. A new customer, you know, if they satisfy the RFP, Journal Technologies wins the RFP, they would build this contract, it's a few hundred page contract. It would lay out how much the licenses are going to cost. And a lot of times they'd start with a, you know, relatively, I'd say, low number of licenses. And they would bill those out over 10 years. So the 10-year contract for $89 million case management system is going to include implementation and licenses. But once the go live occurs, there's actually a number of other revenue sources that kick in. So what are some of the future revenue drivers to this business? There's going to be, and by the way, just so everyone's clear, there's $35 million in revenue today from Journal Technologies, not including everything that's missing or being postponed until a go live. So $35 million is today's revenue. We expect them to have a number of new client implementations, new RFP wins. So that's the first future revenue driver. But there's also going to be additional licenses from existing clients. So once a go live takes place, maybe they have 100 licenses. It's not very long, maybe 1 year, before the courthouse client starts to recognize that maybe everybody should have their own license. Licenses cost about $1,000 per year. So they quickly move up from 100 to 200 or 300. So the number of licenses grow. So that's from existing clients. And then there's also price escalators that are built into these contracts. So sometimes it's CPI, sometimes it says 5%, sometimes it says 2.5%. Basically, there's a little bit of pricing power, and they're built in these 10-year cycles. So whatever is stated at the beginning, it increases every single year in a geometric fashion. I see now I failed to mention, and it's similar to additional licensing from existing clients, but actually, once the courthouse has the software implemented, it becomes very attractive for some of the external agencies to start doing their own implementations, because then they can interface with the courthouse electronically and seamlessly. There's also that source of revenue that I don't even show here on the slide. The fourth item here is the consulting fees. So there's consulting fees for maintenance, support, and go live. And just this last year, there was something quite outrageous. Off the top of my head, it was maybe 60% growth in consulting fees for the year. So once the go-lives happen, the consulting fees really start to move up. There then is also number five, ePayIt, which is a software that once implemented allows anybody who owes a fine, here I list out a traffic citation. You kind of have two choices. You can find an envelope, lick a stamp, find a check if you have one of those laying around, and you can mail it, or you can go online, you can pay $4.99. You can pay your fine. And so once the implementation has gone live, the ePayIt functionality is a big source of future revenue. eFileIt is another similar item. This is for external agencies to upload, or individuals to upload documents to the docket. So whatever cases are being worked on in the justice system, for a very small reasonable fee, you can upload your files electronically rather than carrying in all the paper. And finally, a new service has been popping up in some of the recent contracts for JTI cloud hosting services. So they host the sensitive data via AWS, and that obviously will become a driver of future revenue as well. So in addition to all the missing contractual revenue, once the go-lives take place, it's not only the revenue in the contracts, it's all of these other sources of revenue that start to make big changes to the financial statements. Of course, there's some competition. Tyler Technologies is the 800-pound gorilla. They're, you know, the $15 billion market cap with $1 billion in revenue. So they trade for about 15 times revenue. Equivant and Central Square are out there doing aspects of this as well. But this is a very fragmented market because it grew organically, and it's in a bureaucratic sort of ecosystem. And so a lot of the services are done by local technology providers. And ultimately, this is going to be a few key players that dominate in the US and international markets. So it may be an oligopoly with a few little fragments in different spaces. So what can go wrong? And one of my main focuses over a lot of years. And I've found that there's quite a few things that in many ways are going wrong and need to be fixed and addressed. And I don't think it changes the outcome of the price today versus value, but I do think that these things need to be addressed very head on, very quickly. So number one, risk, which is a problem, are go live delays and scope creep. Because this is so configurable and because the demands are so unique from different isolated courthouses and justice systems and agencies around the world, it's not a cookie cutter out of the box. And currently there's major scope creep issue. It's developers are continuously asked to build and improve new tools. It makes upgrades more challenging actually. And you run into problems like Dallas-Fort Worth, after many, many years, canceled their contract. So you get go live delay and scope creep and ultimately cancellation. That's a very bad situation because obviously then the revenue that was missing never materializes. The firm culture, believe it or not. So we all know Charlie Munger and his deep understanding of the importance of culture. Peter Kaufman has literally wrote a book on firm culture and the importance of culture. You look at Costco versus a Walmart, you understand the difference of culture. Charlie's, of course, on the board of Costco. But the workplace descriptions do not suggest anything close to good firm culture. It's far from it. It's the opposite. They talk about lack of transparency, cultures of mistrust, high turnover, developers having one foot out the door, stock ownership isn't even a consideration. And I'm putting this all very lightly. There's a lot of things that could be improved from a culture perspective. Technical debt is a big issue. Technical debt, meaning that new code is being built on outdated legacy code that's lapsed since the 90s in some cases. So when they go in and do these implementations and set up this initial toolbox, they have to hack together all of the solutions and demands for that particular courthouse. And they're building on a foundation that's crumbling. And so that needs to be addressed in some capacity, because what the technical debt causes is when they go and do a version upgrade 3 years later, the version upgrade will cause some of the hacked tools to break because it was built in a language or in some legacy code that is no longer compatible. So the technical debt causes the margins to shrink in the future, and that needs to somehow be addressed. And finally, the Justware end of life scenario. So Justware was purchased under New Dawn in 2012 for $14 million. It was a great acquisition, and I think all around worked well, and it's a good solution. In February of 2020, a letter went out to all 500 or 600 customers and agencies saying that we are moving toward end of life. We're going to sunset the software. We're excited to have you migrate to eSuites. And the intention is very good. eSuites is a great product. It's the future. It's browser-based. It's SaaS. And that is the intention. However, there are a lot of clients who find it too expensive. There are a lot of clients who find it unnecessary. And the immediate impact is going to be, if we break down the revenues, okay, so there's $35 million in the JTI piece, about $22 million of that annually comes from the licensing. Of that 22 coming from licensing, somewhere from $5 to $8 million is coming from Justware. And in June of 2021, they are shutting off Justware. And so the immediate impact is going to be a $5 to $8 million reduction in revenues. And there might be some offsetting go lives that take place, but it will have a material financial statement impact And the objective to get these folks to upgrade to e-suites should be looked at very carefully. It's a big risk if everybody walks away or starts an RFP process. So very quickly, I'm going to show you some of, I think, the suggestions of how these are the leading indicators that let us know that things are going in the right direction. But, you know, the go lives and scope creep, they're missing some folks like a technical director or director of engineering. There's a lack of transparency that I'm very well aware of, especially between things like sales stream. You know, someone makes a promise, then developers have to build it. And to handle that, they really need better statement of work and some sort of program management office. There is a huge transparency issue. It's been described as job security is about hoarding information. And that's, you know, a terrible attribute. You know, they don't have things like 401k, and it upsets people. They think it's not a career-oriented place because they can't plan for their future. And there seems to be a lack of collaboration going on. In terms of technical debt, I've heard ideas like decouple or decentralize the software. So strip out e-file it and e-pay it, make those perfect so that there's no more foundational issues in various components. And then invest in the foundational code repair. And then as everyone is trying to get to, try to reach, go to a serverless architecture where you can plug and play different components of the software. And in terms of adjustware, end of life, I don't think this is rocket science, but you want to avoid the RFP process because that's what goes into a multi-year period with revenue delays. You want to be very easy for them to implement the solution, start their configuration process, and move to e-suites. I think part of that is treating the adjustware users like partners. And again, just to be very, I think, transparent about it all. So, you know, these are the risks, some of the reduction opportunities, but ultimately, I've put together here a scuttlebutt analysis that I think probably the audience will go back to later. It's certainly too much information to read or discuss here, but you can see things. There's a lot of green, there's a bit of yellow, and there is some red in terms of like the labor and personnel relations. But still from a business perspective, when I look at this, I see a business that's selling for less than a $200 million market cap when you take out the equity portfolio, where there's $100 million in revenue. It looks like there's a clear path to $100 million in revenue later this decade. So if you call it 2030 and there's $100 million in revenue, the competitors trade for 15 times, and that's not even as crazy as a lot of the tech firms. But if you even give them a 10 times revenue, you're sitting here with a $1 billion business tucked inside of this little micro cap that also has an equity portfolio. That equity portfolio over the next few years will grow into the size of the current market cap. And I look at that as a floor to the price. I mean, it's a rational floor. There might be irrational prices at times, but the rational floor would be that, you know, there's a newspaper business, there's a software SaaS business, and it would be strange for it to sell for less than the liquidation value of its equity. So that grows above the current marketplace. That makes it a very muted downside. And if you get $100 million plus and you throw a nice multiple or an even conservative multiple on that, you have a $1 billion business, you know, you're kind of looking at a 1.5, maybe up to 2. And if things go really well, it can be quite a bit larger. I think that's still the beginning of the compounding, actually. So I look at it, it's very slow. It's going to take a long time. But if you're willing to take some bumps along the way, it's like a decade-long Fisher compounder selling at below 6 times revenue, a SaaS business selling at less than 6 times revenue, run by Munger, run by, you know, all these great folks that I listed at the beginning, including Kaufman and Conlin. And, you know, I didn't really mention this, and I will. These guys have defined moats their entire lives. And so if you just kind of think about what moats exist, they have things like network effects. They built in aspects like the pricing power, price increases. They have this deferred gratification ethos. You know, they're not billing and their competition bills day one to do implementations and they don't bill until the end. And by the way, that flips it around so that the IRR becomes positive for their customers. So if they do an implementation and can also cut some costs operationally within their jurisdiction, you know, they get a positive IRR by using JTI. We see it in the contracts. We see it in the RFPs. They look at the competition. They say, this is going to cost us. Daily Journal is going to save us. There's also a lot of trust. They're in win-win relationships with the whole ecosystem. So the courthouses like them. Their customers like them. the government likes them. They're a very good solution, and the customer comes completely dependent on their product. So the switching costs become extraordinarily high. After you've had your software embedded in the Justice ecosystem for a decade, it's very costly to switch. And so they're operating this SaaS solution. They truly have a better product. They have the best product. And it's going to continue to improve, especially with, you know, the ongoing dependence of technology in this market. So, you know, those are the slides I have, and that's a deeper dive into some of the thoughts around this. And John, I'm happy to hear any questions or take this in any direction you'd like.
Great. Well, thanks, Matt, for the presentation. Nice update from when you originally presented this a couple of years ago. Anyone on the line, if you have a question, feel free to type it into the online interface. I guess I would just ask about the risks, which really are quite stark. Let's start maybe with the culture one. Do you think that Charlie Munger is aware of this?
I think that he has most likely been notified, but I'm not sure if he understands the degree of challenges that exist. I hear the same things everywhere I go. Every time I'm talking to folks, it's the same message in totally isolated situations. And the problem is truly that the demand for technology folks is so high that if you have a poor cultural environment and anybody gets an offer and anybody good gets an offer, they're out the door. I wouldn't pretend to argue that if you had an offer from Google and an offer from Daily Journal or JTI that you'd go and choose Journal Technologies. But it is a really powerful product. It's a really great product. In fact, a lot of the folks really love the work that they're doing, and they really like their colleagues. You can go to Glassdoor.com, and you can just get a high-level view of what people think. At first, my first thought was, write it off. These are people who are complaining. It's biased. But as you go and talk to more and more folks, and I've talked to probably 50 employees or something, it's everywhere. Logan used to be a family. A lot of them question what's going on in LA. Scheduled lunch breaks. People talk about going to work as their shift. You know, in a tech environment, people want creative things and it's just not available. And there's really specific things that people get upset about. Like constantly I hear about 401k issues, and you know, in the US, that's how you save for retirement. And I don't know, maybe the board has some reason why they think their way is right. Okay, Charlie has said at the meetings, we just can't teach the new dogs the old tricks. Maybe I'm one of the new dogs he's referring to, but I don't see any reason to not give a 401k, to give somebody a really clear career path. Because what happens is you talk to folks and they say, well, this isn't, I can't be here for my career, because I don't have the opportunity to stabilize my life. So that's really unfortunate. It needs to be addressed. I really would like to see Peter Kaufman taking a bigger role. And one of the leading indicators that this might be happening is that Salzman's had this massive influence for 35 years, and he's basically built things up until now. It's been very much a one-man show. He suffered some health issues. He's working from home, but he's recently sold all of his shares. Kaufman has bought 9.8% of the business within the last maybe 2 months. And I think it would be a huge catalyst, and it'd be great for the long term to have Kaufman leading some change in culture. It's a very difficult thing to change culture. But by the way, it's Mary Conlin on the board, but Tom Murphy, her father, is also famous for having, you know, exceptional culture and just beating everybody at the game because of the way the business is run. So I would love to see things move in the right direction. Certainly right now, it's a big concern.
And then the technical debt seems like a big deal as well. You know, when you marry that and the culture, it's just really hard to see how, absent some really big change, these guys have any shot at innovating.
Yeah, I agree with that. These are very big concerns. And I don't know if the board is aware of these types of concerns or not, frankly. But I will say that I think most firms that have been building software for 20 or 25 years has some form of this issue because the whole world has shifted so much in two decades, and you have your core foundational code that you've been building on. You know, JTI has so much capability and the E-suite software has so much capability, but deep down in it, there is some legacy code that either needs to be overhauled in some tremendous way, or they need to find solutions where things can sort of be decentralized and fixed so that a single upgrade doesn't break things. So it is a concern. I think it's an industry issue as well, but it's better addressed early on. I've heard there's about 10 million lines of code. So you can imagine redoing all of that. You know, you can't just redo everything from scratch. I've also heard that to rebuild it would maybe cost up to $100 million. So the software itself is quite valuable. And I'm not a developer. This is more of the things that I've heard. But I understand that the upgrades then cost more money because they have to go back and fix all of the things that break. So it's better to address this up front, most likely. Anyway, maybe there needs to be some consultants that get brought in. Somehow they have to address this. But it is a risk, John. It's a risk. I still don't think it justifies a $200 million market cap on a $35 million revenue SaaS business that has enormous missing revenues. It sort of becomes like it's just trading at such a low price that even with these issues, we have, by the way, quite a large, I mean, this is a large position for us. It's one of our largest positions. And so I do think it's just so cheap. I don't think it's some melting ice cube. There's a huge, huge runway ahead for this firm. But these things cause problems and they show up later and cause problems. So it's a risk and it squeezes margins.
There's a question from the queue on what do you think is the root cause of the culture issues? And your thoughts on the current operating management and who would likely replace Salzman?
Very good question. What is the root cause? I think there's some friction going on from a few different aspects. And I want to be sensitive to this to some degree because I think directionally everybody wants the same outcome. And the fact that there's a cultural issue is, it's actually just fact. But, you know, they've done a few acquisitions and things. And so sometimes cultures from different firms butt heads. I sort of deduced from a few other ideas, like Charlie's statement, you can't teach the new dogs the old tricks. This board is stacked with these, you know, before Mary, it was just these wise old men who have probably done things in a certain way for decades. And they also know these just unbelievably, they have these life lessons and they know how to build moats. It goes both ways, but I think perhaps some of them, maybe some of their ways of doing things don't work well with a young development community. And I think some of the ways that the young development community wants to operate doesn't work well with some of the senior managers. So that causes an issue and it causes problems. They also recently during COVID did a round of layoffs. And I think that rubbed people the wrong way because they do have a lot of cash and many people didn't think that was necessary. I have no real opinion on that. But ultimately, some of those folks, by the way, would take their job back in a heartbeat. That's a quote. Who would replace Salzman is a major question. And I think it's a question that someone like Mary Conlin and Peter Kaufman and Charlie Munger and probably Salzman also figure out together. One of the main advantages of Salzman, which is just, I mean, he just does so much and he's been doing it for so long that he just knows everything about the whole business. He's been the CEO, the CFO, the treasurer, and the secretary for 35 years. He's invaluable in that respect. And he actually doesn't, I think he's paid $250,000 a year and his son is a consultant for $120,000 a year. That's their salaries. And the board doesn't get paid. I think Kaufman and Conlin get $5,000 a year. The whole operating costs of management and the board, including the relationship with Salzman's son, is like far less than, you know, there's a bonus of $400,000 and then there's this little stock opportunity, but let's put it $1 million. And I just don't know how to replace Salzman for anything like that. I mean, you're just getting tremendous value. But maybe it's an external hire, or maybe it's an internal promotion. But at some point, that will become necessary. He's 81. He suffered a stroke a few years ago. And at some point, something like that will have to change. And I think it's up to the board to find the very, very best replacement. I hope that Kaufman takes a very strong lead in making those kind of decisions.
Another question from the queue regarding JustWare. Is the JustWare sunset priced in, or could it create a buying opportunity when it comes?
It's a great question. It's asking about, you know, the psychology of the marketplace in a way. First of all, everything I've just told you, most people don't even recognize there's a software business side of this company. Most people don't even know the Daily Journal exists. So this whole thing is a big secret. And getting to this level of detail, I mean, you just jumped ahead like 2 years of research. So will JustWare create a buying opportunity? The reason that it could is if somebody's staring at revenue figures and they don't understand anything going on underneath it, and then revenues drop, it might suggest that maybe somebody could sell. If you go to the filings, you'll see that about 50% of the float is owned by people who aren't really sellers. So between Kaufman, Munger, Rick Guerin left some, has a trust, and there's a wealth manager in San Francisco that has quite a bit of stock. And I think BlackRock has a position. It makes 50%. And you can see that in the recent proxy, actually. There's only 50% float. So the shares become volatile. So if the right owner decides to liquidate, it could create a buying opportunity. What I actually anticipate happening, because these other revenues can jump quickly, is I expect them to be somewhat offset. So the fiscal year ends in October. Out of that, let's call it $6 million drop, you're only going to get about a quarter of that in the 2021 filing. So $1.5 million drop in revenue, $35 million is technology, $15 million is newspaper, but $35 million, if you have $1.5 million drop, they're probably going to have go lives of maybe $5-6 million. So it's actually going to keep growing. It's just going to grow slowly. The following year, you know, you'll have a remaining $4.5 or $5 million drop, but you'll have some more revenue that comes in. So maybe it continues to grow or move a little bit. I think it's just going to take a little while. But come 2023 or 24, I expect some of these major go lives like Australia to start hitting. And you could at that point see revenues jump considerably. Maybe they move quickly from 40 to 60 or so. So I'm not really taking my chance. I'm not waiting for this to buy. I don't think it's going to create a huge buying opportunity. I just don't think people are watching that closely. But I do think that people who watch these sort of things and are making buying decisions should be aware that revenue isn't going to jump next year. There's actually going to be a headwind to the revenue. The idea, and I don't mean to go so long on each question here, John, stop me if interrupted it is, but the idea, of course, is that by sunsetting JustWare, they've created a nice path for people to move to e-suites. And then everybody in the long term is happier. It's a single product. They can be all in on this product, and it's a better product. You know, they've built it. The functionality of JustWare is now in e-suites and more. So it's a smooth and good transition for the people that can move. The problem is it is a bit more expensive. So some smaller clients maybe can't afford it. I think some of them feel like they may have been either treated unfairly or wronged in some way. So they actually want to go back through the RFP process. You're going to get a wide range and spectrum of how these folks react. But the idea is a few big clients that move to e-suites will completely satisfy the revenue that's going to be missing from JustWare. I think it's a very intentional and good long-term decision that they're making, but needs to be handled pretty sensitively because they could see revenue drop. And if they don't get clients to move to e-suites, there will be an issue. And there's bureaucracy, and it's going to take a little more handholding than I think is happening currently to get everyone to upgrade.
Here's an interesting question from the queue. Is the new information on potential risks, such as the technical risks and culture risks, does that change your perspective or approach on whether to own the equity outright or through the options strategy?
First of all, I would love to be able to sell puts. For anybody familiar, we did another presentation earlier in 2020 about the opportunities to sell puts as a tool to enter the position. Unfortunately, the Chicago Board of Exchange decides through a very quantitative checklist which firms have option availability, and Daily Journal doesn't have the volume to have options available. So this is something that we bought and own outright. If there were puts for sale, I would certainly be selling puts, getting paid a premium as a tool to enter this position. They're just simply not there.
Got it. Last question from the queue. What is your opinion on consolidation opportunities in this industry?
So I think Tyler's kind of approaching it a little differently, and Daily Journal may be approaching it in a different manner. So there are some consolidation opportunities. I know from just some conversations and things with Peter Kaufman, it's very important, I think, for the longevity of a business to do almost everything that it does very organically, to make sort of sure that the whole ecosystem holds the business together, that it isn't sort of bolt-on acquisitions that can then be fragile in the future. So there's a few ways to look at this. There may be opportunities, certainly probably are opportunities to acquire businesses, and that may be something that they work on. They certainly will have the cash. They have the cash already. However, I'm not sure that that's the objective. It wouldn't surprise me if they made some acquisitions. They've made two over the last decade. I think the idea is to do what they can internally. Another question that sometimes comes up is, why doesn't someone just acquire Daily Journal? And I think the challenge there is that they have all these other strange aspects. So they have a newspaper business that nobody would know what to do with in a technology space. And they have this equity portfolio, and that looks kind of weird to any outsider. An acquisition becomes difficult. If you want a piece of Journal Technologies business, you've got to swallow the whole thing for $500 million plus. And I'd be really disappointed if there was some acquisition of Daily Journal. I think there will probably be consolidation outside of Daily Journal in the industry, because there's so much fragmentation around the US, and then the world is just pretty open. I wouldn't be surprised to see some other competitors sort of pop up and become maybe something. But long-term, this will be an oligopoly. You know, there's network effects and an advantage, and it's going to be dominated by a few key players. And I really expect Journal Technologies to be one of those players. And so for that reason, this just looks so small in such a huge space. You know, Tyler does a lot of other things other than the justice system. I don't know that Journal Technologies would ever branch out, but if they ever exploited all of the opportunities here with making the courthouse and justice system digital, they could just go right on to the next line item and go after the public school systems or the adoptions agencies. And it's just such a big space. It's hard to even describe. So maybe some acquisition opportunities, but I think Journal Technologies is mostly interested in building and growing it themselves.
Great, Matt. Well, we will leave it there. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. I would just also encourage our members and listeners to go back to our conversation in March, where we talked in depth about your options strategy, which I think is quite unique, and everyone can draw some great lessons from that. So thanks again, Matt. Always a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure as always.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. Goodbye for now.